This podcast is for general information purposes only and is not advice. Outside of the United States, this episode is intended for investment professional use only, not for further distribution. Please listen to the end for complete information.
If you really are good at investing, you create companies that can provide good social services for the world, and ultimately you feel like you're doing something useful without just doing philanthropy. You can do it in the investment world, and that's one of the things I think is great about investing. You can build companies, restructure companies, create jobs, and help the country and the world do better things.
Welcome back to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. I'm Eric Weil, Head of Global Investments and Chief Investment Officer here at T. Rowe Price Associates. In this episode, I'm excited to welcome Harvey Schwartz and David Rubenstein from Carlyle, one of the largest global investment firms specializing in private investments, with over $450 billion in assets under management. Harvey is Carlyle's CEO, joining the firm in 2023 after having had a stellar career at both Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. David is co-founder and co-chairman of the board at Carlyle. He's also a Baltimore native and a principal owner of the Baltimore Orioles. He has his own podcast, For the Ages, and is the host of Bloomberg TV's The David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations. Well, David, Harvey, thank you so much for being with us today on The Angle. Really appreciate you coming to Baltimore.
Our pleasure.
Great to be here.
So I thought maybe we'd start off a little bit with the founding of Carlyle. David, I was on the phone with George Roche, who you may remember, CEO of T. Rowe Price, when I joined the firm 20 years ago to talk to him about this podcast. And he reminded me that T. Rowe was an early investor in Carlyle. So tell me a little bit about just the formation of the company. I mean, you weren't in the industry directly before that. And,
you're being polite. I managed to work in the White House for Jimmy Carter. We got inflation to 18%, a very high rate.
Quite an accomplishment, yeah. Actually, really.
Nobody else has
Your
been
job
able to
was
do
to
that.
Bring it down, and you got it to 18?
Nobody's done it since.
You know, people didn't reelect us. And when you work in a White House, you have a lot of cognitive dissidence. People tell you how great you are, and you believe it. And you think you have more information than everybody else. I remember saying to President Carter, Mr. President, you have no chance of losing. This man is 69 years old. Anybody that old can't possibly get out of bed in the morning. I'm now older than that. So Reagan seemed old to us at the time. I was then 31. We lost. And then when you lose an election, you work in the White House, all the people tell you how great you are before, they don't call you back anymore. Nobody wants you to talk to them. So I had to go back and practice law. It took me a while to get a law firm that was willing to hire me. I took about 6 months because nobody really wanted a Carter White House aide when Reagan's in. And I had to tell my mother, I'm her only child, my mother's living in Baltimore, and I had to say, well, I had so many offers, I didn't know which one to take. But I don't know if she figured out that I didn't have any offers, but eventually somebody felt sorry for me. They gave me an offer. I went to practice law, and I realized why I didn't really like the practice of law when I'd done it in New York before the White House. So I had read about Bill Simon, a former Secretary of Treasury, who had done a buyout deal that was very famous, Gibson greeting cards. And more or less, he put in $1 million of his own money and made $80 million in 18 months. So I went down the street to see Bill Miller, who had been Secretary of Treasury in the Carter administration, and said, your predecessor did a leveraged buyout. Why don't you form a leveraged buyout firm and I'll do the legal work for you? Obviously, knowing my legal skills were limited, he said he didn't want to do that. So I ultimately talked to somebody from T. Rowe Price, who I'd met when I was at the White House. His name was Ed Mathias.
Oh, yeah.
A longtime T. Rowe Price person, and he had a habit of getting to know everybody in the world and the worlds he cared about. And he knew a lot of people who worked in the White House and government. And so he said, well, he thought it was a good idea to start a private equity firm in Washington. I wasn't thought to be skilled enough in the investment world to do it. But he said, let's find some people that could do it. We walked around. We talked to many people. We couldn't find two people in Washington had the right skills. And eventually, somebody came to me and said, I'm going to do it, and I want to start this firm, but I'll do it with you. We started with $5 million, which took us a while to raise, and then we built from there. And T. Rowe Price was very helpful. Ed Mathias, who was at T. Rowe for probably 20, 25 years, is now a senior advisor to Carlyle, has been very helpful to us over the years. But if it hadn't been for T. Rowe, I don't think we would have gotten off the ground.
That's a great story. So maybe, Harvey, pivot to you. Fast forward a good number of years, and you've been at Goldman. You have a really long, successful career. We were reminiscing about how you and I first met there 15 years ago when I was the analyst at T. Rowe covering that stock. What brought you to Carlyle?
Well, I left Goldman in 2018, and I actually left with the plan of having no plan. I had worked my entire life from when I was very young, and I thought I needed a break. And that sort of evolved into philanthropy, passion projects, private investing. And, you know, I'd ended up with a nice resume. It didn't start out that nice when I was young, but I ended up with a nice resume. And so I would get calls, opportunities. None of them were really that compelling until I heard from David and the founders. I knew the industry. I knew what was happening in the industry. And having been at Goldman Sachs, I obviously knew Carlyle as a client. I spent a lot of time with the founders, and it really wasn't that complicated at that point to make the decision. I just had to really feel confident that I could have an impact on the firm. But between the industry, the founders, the opportunity set, it really was too much to pass up. And I was at a stage in my life where I kind of felt like, hey, if this isn't the opportunity, then that's fine. I'll just keep doing what I was doing. But it was super compelling, and it's been a lot of fun.
Maybe let's fast forward to where we are today in the industry. A lot has changed. You know, the private equity business still very important to Carlyle, but the firm has expanded. Before we get into where the firm is today, maybe just a little bit about how the traditional buyout private equity business has evolved since, you know, the deal that you referenced.
Well, when the first buyouts were done in the, I'd say, early to mid-70s, they were basically truly leveraged buyouts. Those deals
Did they
were,
even call it private equity, and they just call it
No, the phrase
buyout?
Had not been invented. They were then called leveraged buyouts.
Yeah.
And the phrase leverage became odious, so they just called them later management buyouts. Then the phrase buyouts, or the word buyouts, became odious, so they came up with private equity. And then private equity had its challenges, too. So today, a lot of these firms don't call themselves private equity firms anymore. They're really private investment firms.
So the deal structures have changed. There's obviously a lot less leverage in a typical, you know, leverage buyout today than there used to be. What else, if anything, has really changed in terms of the deal mechanics, the sourcing?
What's changed is you have a lot of bright young people who want to make a mark in the world, and they really are really anxious to kind of learn how to do the skills that you do in private equity and private credit and other kinds of things. You have a lot of people who are, I think, feeling that they can really learn a lot in this business, and then ultimately they might go do something themselves. I spoke this morning to some new people at Carlyle from all over the world. I did it by virtual means, and you know, I was honest. I'd say, look, the truth is that 10 years from now, most of you will probably not be here. 20 years from now, maybe a few percent will be. You just don't know who's going to stand there and not be there in a few years. But what you want to do is train people well. Hopefully, they'll go out and ultimately build nice businesses you can be proud of. A lot of people have left Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, and Carlyle, and have built really wonderful businesses, and you take some pride in that, just as you take pride in your children doing something. And, you know, it's what the way life is. You can't expect people to join your firm and stay there for 20 or 30 years. Everybody's not going to do that. But you want to give people a sense that the importance of the business, why they're doing something well, and why it's an important social good to be doing what you're doing. And just to finish this point, many people think that when you're investing, you're just kind of making wealthy people wealthier or helping some institutions and so forth. But you're also doing a very important social service. An example that I used this morning is basically this. My son-in-law went to work at a small firm that had been in business for 10 years. And he was a Harvard Business School, Harvard Medical School graduate. He was a biotech guy. And he went to a firm that had not one product approved by the FDA in 10 years. And I said to him, look, that's going nowhere. Forget it. Go somewhere else. He didn't listen to me, of course. He went there. And the company was run by a man who really was persistent. And he basically decided, I'm going to persist and do something good for the world, and I don't know exactly what it will be, but he persisted. The investor said, let's take the money elsewhere or take the money back. He persisted. Eventually, COVID came, and the company was Moderna. And ultimately, by his persistence, he did something socially good. And I think what you can do, if you really are good at investing, you create companies that can provide good social services for the world, and ultimately you feel like you're doing something useful with yourself. So, you know, you can do useful things without just doing philanthropy. You can do it in the investment world. And that's one of the things I think is great about investing. You can build companies, restructure companies, create jobs, and help the country and the world do better things.
I totally agree.
Yeah, I think there's been, you know, David captured well, I think, the culture that he and the founders established at Carlyle, which exists today. And it's my responsibility, along with my partners, to make sure that continues to endure. You know, we're you know, for all the presence that Carlyle has at 450 plus billion, we're 2,300 people, give or take. So, you know, as stewards of the firm, it's our responsibility to sustain that culture in the way that David described. I think as an industry, what's happened is a handful of things. If you go back to when David founded the firm in 1987, I think the evolution of private capital in and of itself is an extraordinary phenomenon. You know, it wasn't even called private equity. It was called buyout, LBOs. And you really had that in venture capital. And as we've seen over the past close to 40 years, you've seen the complete evolution of private capital. That, I think, is really critical to how this industry has evolved. The second thing is it's become quite global. You know, it's not a U.S. business. Private capital is a global business. And now you're seeing, and you've seen it for a while again, but now you're seeing an acceleration of kind of where these assets flow in the world. You've seen the excess return that's been generated. And now this sort of evolution of the business is really just the next stage of where private capital is going. But it didn't grow because smart people like David got together and said, hey, I'll create this thing and they shall come. The demand for capital, and you know this well from doing what you do as an expert for a long time, over this, 20 plus year period, we've lost half the public companies in the world.
Yep.
We didn't lose those because they're not great or that's not a good alternative. We took a number of companies public last year across Carlyle, some of the most prominent in the world. It happened because the private capital alternatives were really efficient capital that management teams wanted to take advantage of and run their companies. And so private capital has just completely evolved.
It's an interesting, if I bring these two points together, David's about the importance of investing and how it helps people. We often, and your point, Harvey, about privates, we often remind our associates here that what we do really matters. We have a big retirement business, and we've done the work that if we can generate 50 basis points of extra return per year in our target date franchise for our typical 401k customer, we can extend their retirement by 5 years.
It's enormous.
They can retire 5 years early, or they can keep working and have more.
I'll keep doing it because you're managing my 401k too.
We'll do a good job with that. I really will try. And then to your point on privates, we have seen this, you know, this trend coming. So we started putting some privates going back to, you know, almost 13 years ago into some of our portfolios as a way to help generate that additional return. But the risk, of course, is always liquidity, right? And that's one of the things that you get an extra return for. So maybe spend a little bit of time about how you think about this trend towards the democratization as privates have worked their way into the wealth channel. More and more people now own them. Are you comfortable that everybody fully understands the risks around liquidity?
Definitively not. So this is what I would say. So what's happening is just an extension of what has already happened. You talk to the largest plans in the world. In the United States, 20, 30, 40 million plus firefighters, teachers, they already have their retirement assets in alternatives.
Yep.
Those plans are just being managed on their behalf, as you know. And those plans are managing the portfolio construction and they're managing the liquidity features associated with that. I think the natural evolution around wealth into alternatives makes a ton of sense. I think sometimes when you sit in the United States, there's a sense that this is a U.S.-only phenomenon. This is quite a global phenomenon. If you're in Korea, you're having these discussions. If you're in Japan, you're having these discussions because it's about clients wanting diversification. In terms of how the industry is headed, I think, you know, many of the vehicles are referred to as semi-liquid. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it'd be better if they're referred to as sometimes not liquid at all. Having said that, the people that are managing the wealth for the people that are ultimately the end consumers in their portfolios, they're quite sophisticated and they understand the liquidity function dynamics. But I think as the industry continues to grow, I think we just have to make sure that we work with the industry and the ultimate consumers to make sure that there's the same high level of care we would apply to anything else.
Remember, while public markets are wonderful, sometimes the indexes are not as great as you might think. For example, the S&P 500 up until recently had seven companies that was 35% of the value of the S&P 500, so-called Magnificent Seven. So if you're investing only in indexes that are public indexes, you're not actually diversified all that much compared to where you should be.
Well, you are now officially preaching to the choir.
Are you saying that just because we're sitting in T Row? Like if we're in the ETF Office of America, would you say the same thing there?
Well, I just think it's interesting that people think that if you have an index fund, an S&P 500 index fund, you're diversified, and it's been a great innovation, but it's not perfect because, as we know, the Magnificent Seven is now so much of that. I think at one point, it's not being not now, but 35% of the S&P 500 was
it's those seven
companies.
It's coming back to that level again.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. We're almost there, if not there, today. Yeah.
You know, David used the word innovation. I think these are all natural innovations. They often happen later than they should, and then when they happen, sometimes I think there's an acceleration of activity that just needs to be really well thought out, and I think that's just where we are. But there's no doubt that there's a well mathematically documented argument for why portfolio construction could be improved, whether it's through ETF, active, alternatives for the right application. It's just about how it gets deployed and how this ultimately gets implemented. And I think that's really the issue that we want to focus on.
I would say to some extent, the model that we have is a model that I kind of got the idea from T. Rowe Price in this sense. Mutual funds, when they were set up, they had one mutual fund. Let's say it'd be equity only or whatever it might be. But they began to do brand extensions. You were in equities, you could be in this kind of equity, that kind of equity, and you had multiple funds. And the theory was, if you like T. Rowe Price in this area, we'll give them a chance in a second area or third area or fourth area. So when I was building Carlyle, I said, okay, we're in the buyout business, but if you like us in buyouts, give us a chance in real estate. If you like us in real estate, give us a chance in growth capital. And so we used the same model that the mutual funds had, which have many different products, hopefully the same ethical performance and ethical standards and other high quality things you want to have in all your funds was going to be pervasive throughout the system. And that's what T. Rowe Price essentially did when you have multiple funds and other firms like yours did. And that's essentially what the large private equity firms, as they used to be called, did as well. We just had brand extensions and used the same kind of techniques to kind of get good rates of return.
That is exactly how the business model started here, and you guys were one of the first, if not the first, at Carlyle to go down that path. Let's spend a minute on private credit, if you don't mind. It's been in the news a lot recently. Some high profile folks in the industry talking about what it may or may not mean for systemic risk over time, as the quote unquote banks have been disintermediated or are being disintermediated by the private credit providers such as yourselves. Maybe spend just a minute, Harvey, on sort of where Carlyle fits in the private credit ecosystem and what you think about the disintermediation argument here.
You know, I think the discussion around systemic risk is a misunderstanding of systemic risk. So the word systemic risk didn't even really exist until 2008. No one even talked about what the notion of systemic risk. But if you really unpack systemic risk first, it's a better way to test private credit against it. So my own personal observation around systemic risk, having lived through it, and I was unfortunate at the Federal Reserve the weekend Lehman Brothers went out of business, and as you know, I was co-head of the trading businesses at Goldman during that very volatile time. Systemic risk has a couple of characteristics. One, there's usually massive concentration of risk in a very one asset class. Two, lots of leverage. Mm-hmm. Three, interconnectivity. It's the systemic component that makes it that it's the interconnectivity across financial institutions that makes it systemic. And private credit doesn't really, or credit in the way that we manage credit, actually, it doesn't hit any of those boxes. We don't use lots of leverage. The industry doesn't. The liability structures are very long-tailed. We raise money for 5 to 10 years. We invest money for 5 or 10 years.
The duration mismatch
that really triggers a lot of these things. So there's low leverage. We don't have duration mismatch. And there's not interconnectivity. Now, does that mean that there are no problems in private credit? No. We haven't really had a credit cycle since 2008.
It's been a while.
And that is more about, I think, a question of, can there be bubbles? So we saw a bubble in housing. And we saw a bubble in housing credit. But I think the question of whether or not there's marginal pressure on the opportunities in credit, I think that's a fair question. But that's a question that's existed since the beginning of the history of credit.
Right.
Credit goes through cycles. We just haven't seen a cycle in a long time. Now, in terms of disintermediating the banks, I just don't see that. I think it makes for very interesting stories and headlines.
Banks were set up originally to take deposits and ensure people get a reasonable return and then lend money out. Banks are now doing many other things. Credit cards are a major part of their business. The credit cards weren't originally part of what they were doing. And so just as banks have expanded and done many things beyond just lending, we are, like banks, expanding and doing things beyond just investing as equity investors. And right now, I don't see a gigantic problem. Now, as Harvey's pointed out, we haven't been through a down cycle since the private credit business began to flourish. And I suspect if there is a down cycle, and a severe one, there'll be problems with loans in the bank loans, and everybody will have some challenges.
Sure.
Home mortgage loans, everybody will have some challenges, as is inevitably the case when you have a down cycle. But right now, I think the business is pretty well run, not overly leveraged based on what I see.
You know, risk is, generally speaking, when it's severe, it's not in places everybody's looking. Not to say that sometimes it isn't where people are looking, but if you even think through what happened when we went through the 500 basis point rate increase, which was statistically a one in a million event.
Right.
Nobody saw it coming. That was a pretty good pressure test for the economy, for business resiliency, for banks. And we did lose a few banks.
Yep.
But actually, the system proved to be quite resilient.
When we've had losses in the financial system, the federal government has often come in and regulated, maybe sometimes good, Sarbanes-Oxley is an example, but sometimes overreaching. And I'm always recalling the words of a man I don't usually quote, Ronald Reagan, who famously said the most dangerous words in the English language are, "I'm from the federal government, I'm here to help you."
maybe that's a good time to transition to a little bit about leadership and running the business and some lessons that you all have learned along the way. And maybe I'll start with you, Harvey, as you've come into Carlyle and taken on this role. What have you tried to do to, you know, shape the firm and think about where you want it to be in the next, let's call it, five or so years?
Well, the first thing was, which was most important, was how I came into the firm. You know, all CEOs, new CEOs, whether they're picked internally and they've been with an organization for 20 years or they come in externally, there's a complexity to that transition. It doesn't matter. Even if you've been there for 20 years, I think, you know, you see the firm differently from that seat versus the seat you may have had before. And then, of course, you have whatever unique challenges you have as someone running the business.
Well, and people look at you differently, I'm sure.
Yeah, I suppose. Maybe when you're in the elevator, people notice you a little bit more. I always try to be nice to people in the elevator anyway. So, you know, I'm a big guy. You know, we'll walk out of here and most people think I'm David's bodyguard anyway. Then they look at David and they want David's autograph, and it works for me. I think that for me, I was exceptionally aware of the fact that I was new. I was exceptionally aware of the fact that I came from kind of a different part of Wall Street, specifically Goldman Sachs, obviously. And then I was very aware that they had had a CEO succession challenge, which, again, is not uncommon. But that in and of itself can be disruptive for people because, okay, who's my boss? Really fundamental questions. And so the most important thing for me when I came in was to resist the temptation to make decisions. The firm wasn't in a situation where we had to make a lot of fast decisions. The fundamental infrastructure, the performance, the people, the firm was great. So my only prerequisite really was that I said to the founders, you need to get much more involved. And I think that surprised David when I first said it, because I think he assumed I wanted sort of be perfectly alone and charting my own path. But it was very obvious to me that they had all the institutional history.
Mm-hmm.
They knew everyone. They gave birth to the place. There are people that have said to me over the past couple of years, you know what? David had the biggest impact in my life of anybody. And often that has nothing to do with promotions, compensation. It just has to do with David being David. Or the same thing about Bill, or the same thing about Dan. And so I had to spend a certain amount of time making sure I knew my team knew me, and I understood all of our clients. When I travel the world from Japan to Europe to Southeast Asia to China, here in the United States, there's one common thematic which comes out speaking with people, ministers of finance to institutions, is that the demand for capital around the world over the next 5 to 10 years is only going up. And we're in a unique position because of our global footprint and our capital to be able to provide that capital. And I think that is really, it's quite exciting for all of us at Carlyle, and it's exciting for me.
That's great.
The good news is that God looks favorably on the founders of private equity firms because they tend to live a long life.
That is true.
So they're all hanging around generally. We did lose one not long ago, a very talented man, David Bonderman, but basically, you know, the people that have built KKR and Apollo and Blackstone and Carlyle, they're still around. That's the good news. The bad news is that the guy running the firm has to deal with the founders. And so the trick is to make sure that you can be helpful to the person running the company, but not blur the line about who's really running the company. Harvey's running the company. Founders are happy shareholders. He's done a spectacular job with the company. Its value is higher than it's been in probably in history now. And we'll help whenever he asks us to do so.
David, kind of a similar question, but so recently became the senior owner of the largest owner of the Orioles, taking on, you know, that role from a kind of a different kind of organization. But how did you approach that, and what did you learn taking on a sports franchise like that? And full disclosure, you're talking to a lifelong O's fan, so.
Well, and I appreciate the fact that T. Rowe Price has been a sponsor of the Orioles recently. It wasn't in my natural history. I wasn't really a sports team aficionado. I followed the Orioles when I was a boy, but I've been distanced from Baltimore for about 50 years or so.
But you were a great baseball player as a kid,
right? I was a little league. I was an all-star at 7 and 8, and then I peaked at 9, but also it was a Jewish little league, so there weren't a lot of Sandy Koufaxes actually throwing around there. To be very serious, I've devoted a lot of my resources in philanthropy in recent decades and given away a fair amount of money, but I felt I hadn't done enough in Baltimore. I grew up here. My parents grew up here. My parents raised me here. They were married here. They're buried here. I'll be buried here, no doubt, as well. And I just felt that while I've been on the board of Hopkins, I've given money to Johns Hopkins and Johns Hopkins Medicine, not proportionally enough compared to what I probably gotten out of Baltimore. So when an opportunity came along to give back to my hometown, I thought I would take advantage of it and try to help the city by reviving the Orioles a bit if I could. I haven't yet done that, obviously. It takes some time. But Baltimore, as you know, has challenges. It's a city that has some unfavorable statistics when it comes to crime. The demographics are not wonderful. The city is shrunk in terms of population compared to when I grew up. When I grew up, the city was about the 9th biggest city in the United States. Today, it's not in the top 20 population-wise. So the Orioles are very important to Baltimore. We lost a hockey team years ago. We lost a basketball team years ago. And we had our Colts taken away in the middle of the night. Now we have another football team, an excellent one. But the city, you know, has felt that a lot of people weren't really pulling for it and helping it. And so to the extent that Baltimore Orioles can be revived, it can be help the city and maybe bring corporate headquarters back. T. Rowe Price is one of the few companies that exist where you've built a new headquarters in downtown Baltimore, which is something, unfortunately, other companies haven't done. They've either been sold or they moved to the suburbs. And so by being in Baltimore, you're helping the revival of Baltimore. And I hope by helping to make the Orioles a little bit better than they were, I can help revive Baltimore and give back to my hometown in ways that I think I should have done earlier.
Well, the ownership group has been incredibly well received by the fans. And, you know, I've been to several games and seen you coming out and, you know, throwing hats into the crowd. And it's just been, it's been a really nice breath of fresh air.
You know, for the first year, people wanted my autograph. They wanted my picture. They wanted selfies. They wanted me to sign things. Now, this year, we're not doing as well. And they're not booing me, but I don't notice as many autograph requests. But that's okay. I can take it.
So one of the things that I like to find out from folks like you who've had really long and distinguished careers, in investing, we all make mistakes. It's a part of the business, but learning from those mistakes is really important. So I'll ask each one of you to kind of think about one, you know, seminal mistake that you made somewhere along in your career and what you learned from that. I don't know who wants to jump on that grenade.
How many
first.
Hours do you have? you know, in investing or just generally?
Either one. Yeah.
Well, made lots of mistakes in life. You know, overall, I've studied investors. I've written a book about investing. And what I've learned about investors who are really good is that they learn how to admit their mistakes quickly and go on to the next thing. And not saying, the market's wrong, I'm right, I'm going to hold on this position for 5 or 10 years, and the market doesn't know what I know. That's generally a mistake. So really good investors or really good business people, they figure out when they've made a mistake and they correct it and do as quickly as they can, because that's really the essence of business, is making changes to adapt to the market.
That concept of intellectual honesty is one that we try to teach our analysts almost the first day they're here. If you're blaming the market, then you're not probably not in the right business.
Yes, when you hear people say the market doesn't understand, I know more than the market, that's generally a problem.
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's not one that stands out like David. I mean, you make so many mistakes along your career. I guess if I was to underscore kind of the framework of it, I would say it's either where I wasn't willing to trust my own instincts or I wasn't willing to trust the people around me fast enough. It's usually not about, oh, kind of didn't see it or didn't have a feel for it, but wasn't willing to embrace it. By the way, that could be in missing opportunities that actually ended up being really powerful growth trajectory opportunities, and also could be mistakes. The most painful, of course, are when you sign off on a capital commitment and immediately it goes south and, you know, you lose X amount of dollars because it's so painfully precise and measurable. You know, the bigger mistakes happen if you, you know, don't make a tough people decision. Some, you know, the hardest thing we do in our business, is it really at the margin about, oh, did we commit this one marginal dollar correctly, although it's incredibly important and we measure ourselves by the performance? A lot of it is around people. And when you don't get the people part right, you know, the costs are high for everybody. They're high for you as the manager. They're higher for the individual. And I think really sweating the people part. And by the way, that also means empowering people.
Yep.
And, you know, not micromanaging. But I think when I look back, there are times where I thought, particularly when I was younger, and I was really learning, and I generally consider insecurity one of my core competencies, and I was even more insecure, I could have made decisions a lot faster. And that would have actually helped. So when I look back, I would say it's a lot about personal judgment. And to David's point, it's about being able to reflect and say, oh, I could have done this a little bit better, and about self-improvement. But at the same time, you know, you can't self-reflect for too long.
Right.
Like, you got to be able to move forward. So, like, you have to learn and immediately advance. But you have to be willing to, you know, you have the responsibility. It all sits on me, or it all sits on David. You know, if the Orioles have a good season, David's going to give people a lot of credit. But he just said before, if they don't have a great season, he's the guy.
The two biggest mistakes that I keep punching myself over is when my now son-in-law was at Harvard, his classmate there and at Phillips Exeter was a guy named Mark Zuckerberg. And when Mark Zuckerberg was trying to raise $30,000, my son-in-law called me about it and said, hey, you want to put this money in? What does it do? It's a dating service kind of thing. So those companies never get anywhere. That was a mistake. That $30,000, I've now been told, is somebody did put it in. It's got worth about $33 billion.
Oof.
That was a mistake. And then when Jeff Bezos was launching Amazon, we provided the bibliography for books in print that helped them get started. We had an opportunity to take a large percentage in the company. We turned it down to take cash. And when I later went out to see him and said, Jeff, maybe we'll take the equity, he said, I don't need you quite as much. He gave us a little piece, but we had no confidence in the company. Then we sold it at the IPO.
Oh.
That was a couple billion-dollar mistake
Yeah, there's some mistakes you can quantify. That's
a few, yeah. But you know what? It worked out okay in the end.
Well, it worked out for Jeff okay, and Mark did okay too, but we've survived.
What's the I'm sure you both get asked this a fair amount, but when people ask you for a career advice, you know, younger folks, you know, getting started or kind of, you know, five so years into their career, what do you tell them?
Don't listen to your parents. Generally, your parents, they want the best for you, but what they want might be what they want to do with their life. And my mother wanted me to be a dentist. She thought that was a great profession. No weekend hours, people call you a doctor and so forth. But I didn't want to be a dentist. I think what you have to do is find something that you're passionate about. Nobody ever won a Nobel Prize hating what they're doing. You have to love what you're doing. And you won't know it until you experiment. So try many different things. Try four or five things. I'm probably doing my sixth or seventh thing now at Carlisle in terms of other careers I've had or other jobs. Try many different things. Experiment. Find something you really love, because when you love it, you'll do well at it. And if you hate what you're doing, you're never going to be good at it.
That's good advice, but my kids are going to listen to this, so now I don't know that I'm totally discredited. How about you, Harvey? What do you tell people?
I tell people, young people in particular, because that's how you frame the question, something that someone told me when I was quite young. You know, I didn't have a lot of touch. I had a mentor once who I was very, very impressed by, and I thought that they should have achieved more than they had because I was so impressed by this individual. So in this really naive way, I think I was 24, 25, I said, geez, I would have thought you would have achieved more in your life by now. And I really meant that as a compliment. Of course, you know, that obviously wouldn't have been heard that way. But this gentleman was so gracious that he didn't even make me feel bad about it. He kind of probably understood how naive and clumsy I was. And he said, hey, you know, over life, you're going to learn that careers are 50% luck, 50% skill. And, you know, that really resonated with me at the time. I've had incredible luck in terms of opportunities people have given me and just sitting here with you. And I think that for me, learning that and hearing that at a very young age somehow both let me feel like you can be in control of part of your destiny, but you're not in control of all of it. And I think young people today, generally speaking, and it's really dangerous to, you know, stereotype people, I think they feel way too much pressure that they control like 99% of their destiny and they have to get it right by the time they're 23. And if they don't have, like when I have these conversations, they'll say, hey, this is my plan for 12 years. David didn't have a plan. David, like, you know, he went into the Carter administration and if Carter had won, maybe he'd be doing something totally different. And so I think that the randomness of life has to be accepted. You obviously have to be dynamic around it. But I share that story a lot with young people in some respects so they have a perspective on having gratitude. But I also think that there's too much pressure on young people. And maybe that's a little bit embedded in David's discussion.
Yeah, just looking at the recruiting process in our collective businesses today versus when we got into it, it's changed, you know, in the 25 years since I've been doing this.
And that's about hyper-competition and talent, but it doesn't necessarily need to frame the individual and how they feel their career should go. But I do think it's all self-reinforced. It's a bit of a flywheel effect.
That's great. One of the things that has impressed me a lot so much about both of you is your commitment to philanthropy in different areas, but it's something that I think is really important to both of you. Maybe start with you, David. Talk a little bit about sort of your philosophy around philanthropy and how you approach it.
Well, I didn't grow up with a lot of money, so philanthropy wasn't something that was taught in my household because my parents lived paycheck to paycheck. But when I got lucky in the business world, I realized that and when you have a fair amount of cash, what do? You can wait till you die and give it to your spouse or your children. I didn't think that was necessarily the best thing to do. You know, you can spoil your children by giving them a lot of money. I've told my children many times in speeches, I'm giving away all my money. Hope they listen. secondly, and many people leave their money to charitable organizations upon their death. I didn't really want to wait to do that. I wanted to give it away while I was alive. And so I've begun a fairly large program to give away money in certain areas that I'm interested in. And I've gotten great satisfaction out of it. You could say it's selfish because when you get a lot of satisfaction out of something, you probably are healthier. And when you're healthier, you're probably going to live longer. So as a way of living longer, I'm giving away money and hopefully, you know, I'll be happier as a result of it. The most elusive thing in life, without doubt, is personal happiness. Very few people get it perfectly, and I can't say I have it perfectly, but I found more happiness out of giving away money or helping other organizations. I like to remind people that philanthropy is a word derived from an ancient Greek word that means loving humanity. It doesn't mean rich people writing checks. And you can be a philanthropist by giving your time, which is the most valuable thing. And so when I get involved with a project, I tend to give my time as well because I just don't want to write a check. And so I'm on a lot of nonprofit boards, probably too many of them, because I think that giving your time is also a very valuable way to be a philanthropist and helping other people. And when you think about what is the purpose of life, presumably it is about creating personal happiness. And how do you get personal happiness? It's by helping other people. You don't get personal happiness just by looking at your bank account. It's when you help other people in many different ways that I think you feel happier about yourself, and then selfishly you might live longer.
That's unbelievably well said.
Yeah. I think David captured the philosophy of philanthropy in a way that we all could learn a lot from. You know, for me, like David, I didn't grow up with wealth. I actually grew up with two very kind parents, but unfortunately, they both suffered severe mental illness. My mother suffered from bipolar disorder, and my father suffered really, really severe schizophrenia. And it kind of resulted in me being a bit off the rails. I eventually found my way to Rutgers University. Someone did me a favor to help me get in. I actually got rejected the first time I applied to Rutgers. And then when I was a senior, I ran out of money. I couldn't pay my tuition. I went to a friend. They lent me $3,000. And so I didn't learn philanthropy because my parents were wealthy. They weren't at all. But people's generosity taught me. And I remember the day I ran out of money as a senior and I couldn't pay my tuition, when my friend lent me that $3,000, I realized the power in that. And so when I was fortunate enough, hey, you know, I said before, my mentor said to me, hey, it's 50% luck, 50% skill. There are days I think it's 90% luck that I've achieved what I've achieved. And so I've had, I like being close to the philanthropic things I'm associated with. And to David's point about it being somewhat selfish, you know, it was just last week I was walking out of a building in New York City and someone said, hey, excuse me, are you Harvey? And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, I'm a Rutgers graduate. Wow, you've been an incredible role model for us. Can I shake your hand? Okay, like, that's like seems ridiculous to me. Like, I understand why people do that for David, but not for me. And then because of the mental health challenges my parents had, I've gotten much more involved with mental health and brain health. Over the years, I've sponsored early stage research, and I'm on the board of an organization called One Mind, which does some great things in mental health and brain health philanthropy. So for me, it's been such a privilege to be part of those institutions and be able to give back. Like as David said, it's a bit of a selfish activity.
That's really inspiring, both of you. That's awesome. Maybe last one from me. These are, you know, Harvey, you're living a stressful job as a CEO. David, I'm sure the demands on your time are nonstop, but I'm curious what the two of you do to, you know, if you have a moment of quiet or how you find time to relax, what you do to sort of pull back from the stresses that get into all of our lives, no matter
pull back, but he can answer for himself.
Oh, I do podcasts with people that want to interview me. That's my relaxation. Everything I'm doing, I enjoy doing. I'm now trying to get more things done than I probably can do, but I have, some TV shows I enjoy doing. I like doing interviewing and podcasts I have, and I try to write some additional books. And then, know that if you're going to keep your brain sharp, there are many things you can do, but I'm not good at some of them. They say learn a musical instrument, I'm tone deaf. Learn how to do crossword puzzles, I'm not good at that. Learn a foreign language, I have no language skills. So I kind of do interviewing because if you're going to be a good interviewer, you have to read, prepare, and keep your brain sharp and then parry with the person you're talking to. And so I don't really take a lot of downtime. And the greatest pleasure today probably is this. When I was young, I was not a great athlete. My friends who were great athletes, a lot of them went on to become All-American athletes, particularly in Baltimore and lacrosse. Mm-hmm. Now they have artificial hips, they have artificial knees, they can't move around. I don't have any body damage because I wasn't a good athlete. So when I play tennis with them now, I can run all over the court, and all the people were much better athletes than me when I was younger. Now I can beat them. So that's one of the great pleasures now.
Yeah, that's great. How about you, Harvey?
Yeah. Well, my answer is probably a little bit more conventional, but when I was a kid, one of the ways I compensated for my parents' mental illness was I ended up eating a lot. I ended up being the most obese kid in the school. I got bullied a lot. It was sort of a tough way to grow up. And then ultimately, in response to that, I decided, oh, I should study the martial arts because all the people on TV, they looked good. They never got beat up. Everybody liked them. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe that's a solution to this. And so when I was 18, I started studying the martial arts. And my martial arts instructor, Chris, one night at the end of a class, he said, hey, why don't we do a guided meditation? I was probably 19 or 20. And I got into meditation very, very early. And then it kind of faded away. And then when I was at Goldman Sachs, I can't remember, I switched into one new job and I thought, oh, this is probably a time I should start meditating again. And so I try to meditate. And then I see friends, I have grandkids, like my family time is, you know, the best time.
That's fantastic. This has been a real pleasure. You guys are fantastic for coming here and spending time with us. Learned a lot, been inspired. Thank you so much. This is really wonderful.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I'm Eric Vial. Thank you for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find more information about this and other topics on our website. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle, better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in July of 2025 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside of the United States, it is for investment professional use only. It is not intended to be used by persons in jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. The podcast does not give advice or recommendation of any nature, or constitute an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. All investments are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Discussions relating to specific securities are informational only and are not recommendations, and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. There should be no assumption that the securities were or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with any companies discussed. The views contained herein are those of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. The views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed. Please visit https://www.troweprice.com/en/uk/insights/the-long-view-carlisle for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price, 2025.